This podcast is sponsored by AAA, the American Automobile Association. AAA members get discounts on tickets, resort accommodations, and more at Walt Disney World and other Orlando attractions. If you book a qualifying Walt Disney World Resort vacation package at select AAA offices, you'll receive a free subscription to touringplans.com, as well as dedicated trip planning resources just for AAA clients. Go to AAA.com or ask your local AAA travel agent for more details on this offer. Good morning and welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. Today we're going to be going over the history of Disneyland. Jim and I have flown all the way out from the East Coast to the West Coast.
And just boy, our arms tired.
And boy, our
I'm sorry. It was there. I had to do it.
So let me welcome Jim back to the show. Jim, how's it going?
Great. Particularly, a nice fall morning here at Disneyland. What's not to like?
So for those of you that are listening to the show, perhaps in the Northeast, if it's cold or if it's snowy, if it's rainy, it's a perfect 75-degree day here in Southern California. I'm wearing shorts and a short-sleeve shirt. The sun is out. I can see sort of clouds in the distance, but for all I know, there's special effects over in Tomorrowland. It is just an absolutely perfect day. Thank you guys all for listening. So listen. So today's show, we're going to start with the history of Disneyland. As Jim and I were talking about how we were going to approach these shows, one of the things that I thought would be very interesting would be to discuss how Walt transitioned from the idea of Disneyland into its execution. And as I was telling Jim, you know, it's one thing for people to say, you know, if I ever build a theme park, this is what I'm going to have in it. And it's a completely different thing to say, hey, don't plan anything for next Tuesday because we're driving down to Anaheim. So Jim, what were the steps? Right, what were the steps? What was Walt thinking when he actually made the transition from, okay, this is a great idea, to, you know what, we're actually going to execute this? What were the sort of his key drivers? What sort of moved him along? Who were the key players, and what were the sort of the events that happened?
Well, there's a couple of thresholds that. In fact, to be honest, you know, the classic story when people talk about Disneyland, you know, it's Walt, you know, who was in charge of his daughters during the weekends and took them down to Griffith Park and they rode the merry-go-round. And that's a wonderful story, but that's not how it happened.
Wait, you're saying the mythology isn't true?
Well, you know, the people at Universal love the fact that if you really want to drill down into it, one of the major influences for Disneyland is Universal Studios.
What? I didn't read this in my Edith Hamilton mythology book.
Well, think about it. Here's Walt Disney, okay? It's 1923. He comes out to Hollywood. But, you know, Walt's been struggling as an animator. And he doesn't really want to do that anymore. He's a guy who wants to be a director. He actually brings his film reels out, literally going around town trying to get work.
As a director.
And he ends up, it turns out he had shot some newsreel footage before leaving to come out west, and he had a business card from the newsreel service, and got to the Universal gate, kind of tap danced his way in, and so, you know, it was an inertia of, well, I need to meet with the producer here, and so he walks the footage in. They show it to the producer. The producer's like, "This is nice, but, you know, I don't think we have anything for you." But Walt didn't leave immediately. Walt wandered Universal Studios and walked the sets of, you know, the Westerns, and walked where The Hunchback of Notre Dame had been shot, that wonderful, you know, European village square area. And
in my day, this was called trespassing. But,
well, yes. In fact, Walt was a rather successful trespasser. He went back 4 days. You know, he spent a lot of time. I mean, mind you, he hung at the edge of sets watching, you know, because he thought, I will learn how to direct by watching directors. But at the same time, he's taking in this atmosphere. He's taking in, you know, and it's like, it's how wonderful it is to walk down a Western street, how wonderful it is to turn a corner and, you know, you go from Europe, you know. But again, Walt never forgot anything. In fact, you know, Mark Davis used to tell this great story about, God forbid, you know, you ever contradict yourself. I mean, if you're talking with Walt, say, we should paint everything white. No, what, blue? It's like, no, wait a minute. In 1962, we were having a cheese sandwich. You said everything should be white. You know, it's like he never forgot anything. And so he files that away. All right, now, jump ahead. We go ahead 15 years. Walt Disney is now a hugely successful film producer. He's got his own film studio. In fact, Snow White had done so well, and they had so outgrown the Hyperion thing, they actually bought this huge plot of land in Burbank, and they built this state-of-the-art studio. But the problem is, and then they put Pinocchio in production, they put Bambi in production, they put, suddenly all of the money that, you know, literally $7 million has been plowed into the building and plowed into the film, and now war breaks out in Europe, and all the European markets dry up. And Walt, you know, one day, you know, Bob Jones, who works in Disney's model office, gets a call. It's like, Walt wants to see you up in his office. And now Bob was the guy, if you were, you know, for example, if Stromboli's Wagon, if you were an animator who was trying to figure out how Stromboli's Wagon worked, that setting, Bob would build you a version of Stromboli's Wagon, you know, 1 inch to 1 foot. So you could, okay, new wheels would move like this, and the axles would move like that. And it's like, you had visual reference before there was CG.
Nice.
Anyway, Bob goes to Walt's office. And Walt has the model of Geppetto's toy shop that Bob built on his desk. And just the conversation starts off in this really weird sort of way. How much to make this bigger? Like, well, what do you mean bigger? You know, like, bigger. If I wanted to walk around inside of that, how much would that cost?
You want a room?
Well, no, that's it exactly. It's like, what is this about? And, you know, Walt proceeds to tell Bob the story of, look, 15 years ago, I walked around Universal Studios, and one of the things was I snuck onto the lot, but they let people onto the lot. You paid a quarter to come in and watch movies being made. And, you know, we get all these people who come to, you know, come to the gates and want to see movies made. In fact, it's just a little side ramp here. Famous story about at the gate of Hyperion Studio, there would be so many people who showed up at the height of the popularity of Mickey Mouse in the 1930s. People would show up and say, like, can I see Mickey? And it's like,
And, you know, funny story. Doesn't actually exist.
But the guard, you know, to give Walt credit, and more to the point, the guys at the guard shack credit, they finally figured out what to do. They literally, they put two tiny toy cars out by the guard shack. They literally created parking spots for them. And people would show up and kind of see Mickey and say, oh, you just missed him.
Just went out for lunch.
You know, just like he and Minnie, they see, here are their cars. They just came into work, but they realize that they're going out. They're off the lot for a little bit. But, you know, if for people like you who came by, they have these autographed pictures, and they'd hand them a little photograph, and people went away happy. And, you know, this story actually held up for years until, you know, one of the guards, you know, told this great story. But one day, little kid, you know, it's like, guy's in the middle of his spiel about, well, you just messed them. And it's like, they're out. He's like, the kid, you're lying. And it's like, okay, why? And it's like, well, if they were going to the store, they would have taken their cars, you know. It was like, so. And little Dr. House went on to have a wonderful career after that point. So anyway, back to Bob Jones and Walt Disney.
So he's doing the Geppetto thing, and he says, how much to make this bigger?
How much to make this bigger? More to the point, how much to make, and you know, literally, people want to come to the studio. Let's let them come to the studio. You know, the idea was to carve out a 2-acre portion of the Burbank studio.
Okay.
But to fill it, was going to be a little Bavarian village. And you could walk through storefronts and see how animation was made. And you could, you know, in fact, at one point, they were actually talking about a Seven Dwarfs mine train ride. And Bob, who had made...
It'll never happen.
It'll
never happen.
But, you know, and Bob works, you know, on this for quite a while. And you know, it was within inches of happening when suddenly Pearl Harbor gets bombed, and the very next day, you know, the U.S. Air Corps moves on to the Disney lot. They basically take over the lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, for 5 years, Walt can't get the army out the door.
So even in 1940, Walt was already thinking an immersive environment, a village,
yep,
and storytelling and walking through. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just here's some sets and you're going to walk through them and understand.
And a ride, you know.
Okay, so you would ride through the...
Literally, the Seven Dwarfs mine train. In fact, you know... I think that's the thing that kills me the most, the notion of here we are, you know...
70 years later.
Finally, we get this. Anyway.
That's it. They go through the war, and they're making essentially war films, right?
Right. And, you know, the war ends, and, you know, it's a really tough time in the studio. And Walt is under a tremendous amount of pressure. And in fact, one of the things that Disney Company really doesn't like to talk about is Walt. Nervous breakdown.
This is where he had his episode. He had the vapors.
And extended.
Pearl clutching.
It's like, you know, typically when you see Walt sent off on a cruise, there's a reason, right?
He was gone for 6 months.
You know, it's like, time to put Walt on the boat. You know, and he just comes and rests, and he can get back to work. And, you know, during this period, he was under so much stress, the doctor said, look, literally, you need a hobby. You know, find a hobby. And so you know, looks and like, well, Ward Kimball seems very happy. What the hell does he do?
Ward Kimball, he's looking around wrong.
Yeah, you know, and it turns out, well, Ward
seems adjusted.
You know, actually, Ward was batshit crazy. I mean,
was he really?
Oh, you know, I mean, ED next year. There's a book coming out next year. You gotta get. Anyway, you know, so he checks in a Ward. Ward actually does backyard railroading.
Backyard railroading.
You know, just, you know, he finds old trains and set up a train track. And, well, this is...
So we're talking about little model trains that you had as a kid,
see,
right?
Now, this is the thing. That Ollie Johnston did do tiny little model rail... Well, but tiny as in you could ride on it. You know, they were, you know, not HO scale. They were, you know, but Ward, on the other hand, went the entirely different route. Ward would go out and buy actual trains. Buy a train. And, you know, build the route in his backyard.
You know, that's a backyard.
But again, you know, the sort of foreshadow, you know, he bought a walnut orchard, you know, and it's like, set up the train track there, and, it, you know, it's far away from neighbors, and hey, it really worked out. So Ward, you know, and Walt basically piggybacks, you know, it's like, all right, I'm taking over your hobby. And Ward was like, well, I'm going to this train show in Chicago in 48. Do you want to come? And it's like, okay, sure. And again, and it turns out, and it's a, I mean, it's a ridiculous train show. It's a celebration of 100 years of rail. And they do things like they'll roll out historic, you know, full-size trains that have been, you know, reconditioned. But it's not just the trains. It's people in costume, you know. And it's like, and Walt's sitting there in the audience. He's just loving it. It's like, wow, look how people are responding to people in costume.
It's another immersive thing.
Yeah. And he, in fact, he loved it so much at one point, he volunteered to end up in the cast of one of the tableaus. He was the engineer leaning at the window. And so on the entire ride back, Walt, you know, in fact, Ward describes it, I'd be in my sleeper car and like knock at the door and say, oh God, it's Walt again. Because Walt with chronic insomnia, and so yeah. It's like walk at the door with two glasses of whiskey and proceed to tell his life story and smoke, and it's like, I just want to sleep. It's a sleeper car.
Sleeper car, not a talkie car. You know. Sleeper car.
But during the time back, Walt began talking about the Mickey Mouse Park. That, you know, yeah, we had this idea we were going to do in 38. And it's like, wouldn't it be cool to take the stuff we just saw at the train show and put it in that? And so now, you know, 48, 49, you know, John Hinch describes one day he comes into work and he pulls into the parking lot of Disney Studios, and Walt is across the street in the vacant lot next to Disney Studios, you know, our Riverside Drive. And he's out there pacing, you know, literally pacing off the land. And it's like, John goes across the street, Walt?
How's it going?
You know, what's going on?
Good. What color is the sky today, Walt?
You know, and what Walt is doing is pacing off his park. But now, this version of the park, though, is very specific. It's Main Street USA-esque. It's, you know, in fact, it sort of feeds off of the two live-action films that Disney had done, you know, with animation during that period, Song of the South and So Dear to My Heart. You know, it's a celebration of Americana with a little touch of the American West.
Right.
And it's, but again, it's, you know, but now we've gone from 2 acres on the lot to 7 acres across the way, and then Walt finds out, well, you know, actually, if we bump it out of it, we can get 11 acres in. And he really begins to seriously develop this idea. And
so it's still an idea at this point. He hasn't bought the land or anything like that.
Yeah,
right?
In fact, that's...
Has he gone to Roy and said, hey, I'm going to need $1 million.
Well,
or is Roy looking at it going, oh God.
Well, again, you know, they're Lillian and Roy are having conversations at this point. It's like, is it time to send him on another cruise? You know, it's time to put Walt on a boat. And it's like, no, we're kind of okay. Maybe this is serious. And Walt actually gets to the point where they develop the plan for Burbank. So far along, he actually appears in front of the Burbank City Council.
Oh, so he actually goes for some... Was it an FYI, this is what we're thinking of doing, or, hey, we need your approval for this?
It was,
or was it sort of like a feeling out thing? What if we did this?
Well, it was the pseudo-approval meeting. In fact, it ended really badly, because there was one member of the council who just flat out said, no, we don't want an amusement park here, and we don't want drunken sailors falling in your lake. And it, you know, and the irony is, of course, you jump ahead, you know, of... You know, 30 years, and here's Burbank begging Disney to build something in the studio district. It's like, you know that thing you were going to build, you know,
30 years ago with Walt.
You know, could you build one of those now? We need a tourism attraction. But meanwhile, you know, in a weird sort of way, it's a blessing because the idea has now outgrown, you know, the 11 acres that are available. And more to the point, even if Walt had built it within a couple of years, the 134, the highway that actually goes through there, would have cut through right through that chunk of territory.
Oh, so they would have had to develop. Yeah. So when you say it's expanded out, has he got more ideas for more lands beyond the Americana thing, or is it?
It's starting to take on he figures that it's like, well, we have to use what we have. We have to use our characters. It's one thing.
Okay.
And in fact, that's what I think people always don't understand about Walt Disney, that he was a pragmatist. He understood that, for example, again, for the longest time, this was the Mickey Mouse Park, because, again, most popular character, let's use that as our hope to get people through the door. It was very late in the game it became Disneyland.
It was Mickey Mouse Park until it became Disneyland.
Yeah, okay, and more to the point, it was like, all right, so, and face it, people, oh boy, I'm going to go to a recreation of America. It's like,
In America.
Because the recreation of California in California works so well. So, anyway, but that's another story.
Another episode.
Okay. So, at this point, Walt begins folding in elements of his most popular characters, whether it's Snow White. And in fact, Cinderella had been such a huge hit at this point.
Okay.
In fact, that's one of the more interesting moments in the history of Disneyland, when they kept going, well, whose castle is it? It's Snow White's. It's Cinderella's. What movie's coming out in 45 years? Sleeping Beauty. To be named later.
They're doing naming rights auctions on the princesses.
So now he realizes that, look, we're going to need a pretty good chunk of land.
Okay.
And this is when he reaches out to Stanford Research Company. This is actually where Buzz Price came involved. Buzz, who did land searches for most of the Disney parks over the course of his life.
Really?
The interesting thing is they came up with a business plan. They needed property that was relatively affordable. They needed property that was going to be near major highways, so they could get people to it. And more to the point, they needed a large chunk of land. They figured they needed at least 100 acres.
Wow. And okay. So it had gone from 2.
Yeah.
To 100.
Because at this point, it's parking.
Right. You got to do parking. Yeah.
So Stanford begins hunting, and meanwhile, Walt continues the research. In fact, there's some. He spent a lot of time at Knott's Berry Farm walking around, but it was more to the effect of not necessarily stealing ideas from the park, but watching how people walk through things.
How it works.
How wide roads. And again, it was literally sweat equity. He learned the business by visiting all of these things and never forgetting anything. And one of the things that Walt realized was that, going to hundreds of amusement parks around the world and that sort of thing, that most of them had multiple entrances and exits, and it was like you couldn't really tell a story when people could come in from the middle. It's like,
yeah.
We need one entrance, and we need people to drive people to certain points. And he took a lot of the storytelling skills that he learned off of the animation and films and applied those to the park. And but in the meantime, the problem is that it creeps up from 1 million to 1.5 million to 2.5 million. And he realizes, the company, which is still, don't get me wrong, Cinderella was a hit.
Yeah. What year are we at right now in the time?
We are now 1950.
Okay.
But he realizes that, and he immediately turns around and takes Cinderella profits and pumps those into, making Peter Pan, Alice in Wonderland.
Sure.
Just, again, the idea of keeping the films going, Lady and the Tramp. And so it's like, And again, to sort of set a pattern that would continue through the history of the Disney theme parks, it's like, I don't want to use my money to build this. So they begin meeting with various folks. And, and about the same time, of course, television is rising up. I mean, 48, thereabouts.
Is he meeting with people or is he meeting with corporations?
Well, initially, in fact, there's a rather famous story about he met with Bob Hope, who was supposedly one of the smart... again, people know Bob Hope as the legendary comedian, but he was also one of the smartest businessmen in entertainment history. He owned, at one point, a third of the land around Los Angeles. He would take the money he'd make from his comedies and plow it into real estate. He was, in oil fields and was fabulously wealthy. And Bob remembered meeting with Walt, and to the dying day would just tell the stories about Walt with Anaheim. You got an orange grove in Anaheim. All right, I made all money buying land where people wanted to live,
not where orange trees wanted to live.
And it's like, And he said no, and it just, in fact, he spent the rest of his life trying to get back into bed with Disney.
Did he really?
Well, for example, I mean, remember, he was one of for the opening day of the opening special of Walt Disney World, he's there. And in fact, when they broke ground for Disney MGM Studios, Bob Hope is there, because he's trying to convince Disney, you know, part of your entertainment museum, you know, again, it was the MGM studio tour at that point. Why don't we do the Bob Hope Museum? I'll bring my props, I'll bring my scripts, and we'll make that an attraction here. And they're like, thank you, Bob. Just pick up the shovel and turn the soil, okay? You're here for the photo op, old man. Go home.
So you had your chance.
There you go. But anyway, and he's meeting, and he just... nobody can get it. Nobody can... In fact, there's kind of a famous story about when they're in the middle of construction of Disneyland, and Roy's out there, and they've got to go to the bankers, they can get more money. And one of the bankers said it flat out to Roy. It's like, what happens if this fails? It's not a problem. Okay, we'll just come out here and shoot movies. We'll do our, you know, turn of the century movies here. We'll shoot our westerns over there. We'll do a couple of fantasy films. We'll rent it out to other studios. We'll make our money back. Don't worry about it. I mean, Roy had a plan if it crashed and burned.
Roy had the plan B.
Yeah.
It sounds like he might have made that up on the spot.
Well,
look at these fabulous sets that we're building.
Yeah, Roy. Again, you know, Roy was no dummy. And
no,
in fact,
no, no.
That was. In fact, Roy was the one who actually insisted at one point, kind of a famous story, that they were trying to buy the rights to the Wizard of Oz books,
right.
And they found out that the L. Frank Baum's family had lost the rights to the books. Not only that, you know, they were virtually penniless because, you know, he hadn't hung on to his own intellectual property. And Walt, you know, and Roy kind of looked at it and went like, wow, we need to make sure that our children are taken care of.
Right.
So they literally made the company buy the Walt Disney name, you know, and pay Walt and Roy a fee for the Disney name. So they would have an out, so even if Disney got bought, even if Disney went down in flames and broken up, they'd still have to pay the Disney family for the Disney name.
Wow.
So anyway, again, looking for money for this project that keeps creeping and getting bigger.
So at some point, Walt had to go to Roy and say, okay, Buzz has found the land. This is how much money I need. What was that conversation like?
I won't lie to you. It was tough. You know, and again, Roy and Lillian were very, very concerned about it. In fact, Lillian wouldn't allow this project to go forward until certain things were put in place to make sure the family would always have money. You know, and, you know, the house got signed over to her name. And because, again, you know, Walt was doing things like selling off his you know...
Life insurance.
Yeah. And his vacation home out at Smoke Tree Ranch. And it was just one of these things where, Lily, you were putting the house in my name and, you know...
Yeah, she's setting up firewalls.
Yeah. Okay. You know, just to protect them if this goes down. But Roy, you know, ever the pragmatist, sees this as an opportunity because he's been watching the people walk through the door, mm-hmm. and go, hey, would you consider doing a Walt Disney television series? And it's like, you know, because again, you know, with the fortunes of the company rising and falling on whether or not, you know, an Alice in Wonderland hits or a Peter Pan hits,
yeah.
It's like, it would be really nice if we had a steadier income.
So he's trying to diversify just to...
That's it, exactly. Yeah. And so it's like, all right, well...
It's also a year or two between films, right? So it's up, it's down, it's... Okay.
And more to the point, this is... You've got to remember, this is back in the day when Disney didn't distribute their own films. This was, you know, in fact, if you look at the early, early films, I mean, Disney stuff was being released through United Artists. Disney stuff was being released, you know, through, at this point, RKO, the Howard Hughes. And that's a whole other story about...
Did they get along famously?
This was when Howard was still the famous aviator as opposed to crazy man with long fingernails.
Okay.
But yeah, they, you know, Howard got what Walt was and Walt got what Howard was. And it's like, okay, we can do business, you know. Anyway.
All right, so they're putting these firewalls in place for the Disney
and
family. And then Walt goes to Roy and says, okay, I need $1.5 million.
And Walt and Roy starts beating the bushes. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who goes to New York and has the conversations first with CBS.
So he's okay with it. Well, Roy's like, okay, I kind of sort of see it.
Well,
because there's no business plan at this point. It's an idea, right?
It's an idea. And more to the point, Roy kind of sees it as a means to the end, because it's like, you know, this may not actually happen, but we will be in television. You know, so...
Got it.
Okay, so, you know, who knows? This may run out of gas. Walt has worked on things that haven't been built, but we're going to be in television. So he goes to NBC and literally can't get to General Sarnoff, the head of the network.
Really, won't meet with him.
Well, it's just one of these things where the lower vice presidents, I mean, everybody was keeping on their little chunk of power, and it's like they didn't want to be the one to kick open the door. Ironically enough, you know, 61, 62, NBC so heavily courted Disney, you know, in fact, the Wonderful World of Color, when they moved, you know, it's like, come to NBC, we will put you in color. And, you know, they were big-time sponsors, you know, between them and RCA of the original Walt Disney World. They learned their lesson.
Okay, all right.
All right. But anyway.
So they bought Hope.
Well, there you go.
you could get a consortium of people who doubted Walt together and finance almost anything. You know, anyway, all right.
All right.
So he goes to NBC. NBC says, no thanks.
Okay, now he goes to CBS. And same thing. It's hard to get through to the people in power. Mind you, what's ironic is that CBS did the first two holiday specials. You know, the One Night in Wonderland, and, you know, the first things that sort of showed that what a Walt Disney television show could be like.
Right.
All right. Meanwhile, here's ABC, which is basically a spinoff of the Dumont Network. In fact, 13 affiliates at this point. In fact, the joke about ABC at that point was it stood for the Almost Broadcasting Channel. And so they were like, oh, yes, please. We don't care what it is. We want in. And... So it's like, so they put together an extraordinary deal. They agreed to put up $7.5 million for.
They had the money, $7.5 million.
They recognized that if this crash and burns, we still get Walt Disney, and he's agreed to do 5 years of television for us. And
oh wow!
And remember, they didn't just get, you know, the Disneyland television show. They got Zorro. They got the Mickey Mouse Club.
They got the catalog.
Yeah, they got very... Well, these were all created for ABC.
Oh, so they got the creative... Okay.
Yeah, so they you know, right from the get-go. This actually helped them.
So Roy pitched, hey, we're going to create some more series for you, too.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that's...
So, but at the same time, it's seven doesn't quite finish it off. And at the same time...
$7 million doesn't quite finish. So it goes from $1.5 million to seven, and that's not enough.
Well, you gotta understand that...
I'm remodeling a house right now, so I completely get where you're coming from.
Well, I mean, for example, the famous story of when they're actually constructing Disneyland. And here's Joe Fowler, another great story. Joe Fowler was a guy who was building subdivisions at this point. And Walt, it's like, can you come down for a couple days and consult? You know, just...
A couple days. Thursday, Friday.
And...
One weekend. Anaheim.
One of these things where eventually, it's 3 months later, it's like, my subdivision, I got to go finish. Like, no, I'm sorry. But Walt would show up at the work site, and it's like, I gave you $1 million. Where's the money? Where's anything? And Fowler had to explain to him, Walt, these aren't movie sets. Yeah. All right? I actually have to put plumbing lines in. I have to build foundations. And so Walt had to go out and find more money. And so he would do things like...
You're not building one side of the house. You're building all four.
No, that's it exactly. And so, you know, Walt went to Western Publishing, which did a lot of the Disney comic books and the coloring books. And, you know, that's a nice little business you have there. It'd be a shame if we took our stuff elsewhere.
And God forbid anything bad should happen to the stuff that we own.
You know, it's like, okay, here's some money. You know, and meanwhile, the Stanford Research outfit, you know, they get this. They get
really
what it's going to be. And... The VP who's in charge of Stanford at that point, the most important man in Disney history, you know, for Disneyland history, and completely erased at this point.
What's his name?
C.V. Wood.
C.V. Wood.
He is the Harold Hill of Disney history.
Okay.
All right. He was the guy who, when they were building Main Street and realized they just ran out of money.
Yeah.
He's the one who's out cutting deals. To, you know, for example, putting in the corset shop. You know, for opening here at Disneyland, there was literally the Wizard of Bras.
Yes, yes.
You know, and...
So wait, so he belonged to Stanford Research. What was his stake in Disneyland?
Well, no, he saw it as an opportunity. It's like, look, we found the land for you, and, you know, I have some... I've worked in the aerospace industry. I know people who work construction. I can wheel and deal.
What is he getting out of it? What is Stanford Research, or what is he getting out of it?
Well, no, he was the first VP. He was literally the first employee for Disneyland.
Okay, so was he hired by Disney at this point?
Yeah.
Okay,
Disney. Okay. In fact, what's fascinating is that if you look at the early histories of the park when they're constructing it, it's Walt looking at a blueprint, and here's CB literally right over his shoulder.
Really?
Okay. You know, this guy got this place built. You know, and by hook and by crook. I mean, you know, for example... You know, the famous story of the opening of... it's the opening night of the park. You know, or it's the night before the park opens.
The night before.
Highway ramp isn't finished. You know, and it's like... At, you know, 5 o'clock, the highway crew is going home, and CV pulls up in his car. Boys.
Gentlemen.
You know, it's like, I need my ramp. And it's like, you know, and just starts handing out money and says, like, and opens the trunk and it's full of beer. And it's like, and ice. It's like, you know, what's
some ladies might be driving by later. I'm just saying.
What's it going to take? All right? I mean, he was the necessary scoundrel. Walt was the dreamer. Walt was the idea guy. But when it comes to something like that, where it's concrete, it's wood, and there are people to bribe. I mean, for example, when they're...
Bribe is such a harsh word, Jim. All right. Incentivize. There are people to incentivize.
For example, you know, that when they were... It came down, the park was you know, we're 3 weeks out. But now there's an asphalt strike. You know, and
there's an asphalt strike.
Literally, the workers will not deliver asphalt to the park. And CB's like, well, that's for Orange County, isn't it? And he drives down to San Diego. And, you know, literally after hours...
Asphalt scabs.
Yes! Drive up with asphalt! And, you know, he was the guy who, if corners had to be cut, if, you know, if deals had to be made, if bribes had to be paid, CV's doing it. While Walt, on the other hand, is the guy who's on television talking about, you know, the wonderful...
He's promoting it.
And the saddest part of the CV story is that it wasn't enough to do this. I mean, he wasn't just cutting corners... You know, to get this place.
He's making the deals. He's talking to the workers.
He's
the liaison between management and labor, right?
And more to the point, he's also one of these guys who's not afraid to work an inside straight. So the park's open about 3 months at this point. And Roy, being Roy, is going over the books. And it's like, what's this concession company? And it's like, look, we've been doing business with toy companies and publishers all the... I've never seen the name of this company before. And so, well, it's out of Chicago. And it just something rubs Roy the wrong way about it. So he actually hires a private detective who flies to Chicago. And it's a drop office. I mean, just literally, you know, there's a mail drop box in it that then forwards it, you know, it goes to New Orleans and then goes to that office and it's another drop box. And eventually... it goes back to Texas, and C.V. Wood is a good old boy from Texas. And what basically Roy found out was that C.V. had basically set himself up to sell the souvenirs for the theme park, had set up a shell company, and it wasn't enough that he was being the vice president.
He had to get the concession as well.
I got this from Van Francis, who was the head of training here for the park, and the terrible thing is that Walt found out about it. Fired him on a Friday in December. The following Monday morning, CV has set up Marco Engineering and proceeds. He's going to build the master builder of Disneyland is going to build theme parks all around the country.
Oh, Lord.
And he becomes Disney's competition overnight because he went into the office, he grabbed every file, he had the name of every contractor, every designer, every ride manufacturer, and just went into business the next day. And he built Pleasure Island outside of Boston. He built Freedom Land in the Bronx. He built Six Flags over Texas.
Really?
Yeah.
No, it's just Texas.
You know, so, and, you know, but again, colorful, wonderful character. But again, this park would not exist. You know, and again, this park is here because Roy Disney was smart enough to go after the TV money, and C.V. Wood was smart enough to cut the deals and that wad of cash that's fallen on the ground there.
Is that your cash that fell?
No, whatever.
No, well, all right, so C.V. gets the place open.
Yeah.
So we get the crowds there, and they pay their admission, they get in line, and they walk through the gates. And I think this is a great place to stop this particular episode. We'll pick up then with what the crowds see walking through Main Street on the next episode.
Very cool.
Great. Jim, thanks very much for being on this on the show. Folks who are listening, thanks very much for doing so. And if you could leave us feedback on iTunes and suggestions for other shows, I'd greatly appreciate it. For Jim Hill, this is Len Testa. You've been listening to the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. Thanks, and we'll see you on the next show.